Let the record reflect, the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Carrick, Representative Wright, Representative Prox, Vice Chair Representative Ruffridge, and Representative Fields, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO and my staff, Clark Bickford, Committee Aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have an affordable housing hearing and an overview with representation from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Association, or the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities, Alaska Home Builders Association, Cook Inlet Housing, and the Alaska Bankers Association. Thank you all for being here. We will start with Mark Romick, Deputy Executive Director of AHFC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Mark Romick with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Great, thank you. What I'm going to do today is just kind of give you an overview of what the corporation is involved in across the state and a little bit about the housing market in preparation for the other folks that are going to be coming on after us and giving you a little bit more detail about their specific areas. But I'm just going to go through the slides relatively briefly. If you go to slide number two, it has the mission of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, you can see right there, the corporation has been around since the early 50s, and we recently celebrated our 50th anniversary. Our most recent annual report and a video timeline of our first 50 years are available on our website at ahfc.us. In general, we have a very broad mission to provide Alaskans access to safe, quality, affordable housing. Slide three. In terms of the corporation's operations, we have roughly 300 employees with 16 offices around the state. We support 16 units of public housing in not quite 16 communities, and also 6,000 vouchers. Now, the voucher program is a little bit different from public housing in the sense that public housing are physical structures that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and operates, and the vouchers are those rental assistance program that works with the private sector and allows recipients of the vouchers to rent in the private sector. As many of you know, the corporation pays a dividend to the state every year, and for FY23, it's estimated approximately $23 million. We also work very closely with the 14 regional housing authorities that provide complementary housing functions throughout the state. You're going to be hearing from Chris Kolarek a little bit later from the Association of Housing Authorities. AHFC is also a member of the association, we work very closely with the regional housing authorities, and they're great partners for us. As part of the 6,000 vouchers that the corporation manages across the state, we also have a number of special set-aside programs within that, specifically targeting the housing assistance for veterans, homeless, victims of domestic violence, persons with disabilities, people that are on parole or probation, and youth in foster care. All of those set-aside programs are included in part of the 6,000 total vouchers that we have. In addition to providing housing under the public housing banner, we also offer a variety of programs to our tenants in terms of job training, education, and skill building to help help those families improve their income and potentially move back into the private sector housing market once their income has risen to a sufficient amount. Another thing about Alaska Housing is that most of our $100 million operating budget is federally funded. We're on about a 70-30 split between federal funds and corporate receipts. That's on the operating side as well as on the capital side. The majority of our capital budget comes from federal programs as well. Slide four. In terms of AHFC's performance and what's happening with us right now, our mortgage portfolio is stable. I'm sorry, was there a question? Okay. Portfolio is stable, although as the interest rates have begun to rise, we have seen a small reduction in our rural loan pipeline. I want to just point out that in the mortgage industry, we are not competitors with the banks and mortgage companies. We buy mortgages from the banks and mortgage companies and offer special programs for veterans, lower-income families, and rural homeowners. Our closest competition, I guess you'd say, is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at the national level. On the good news front, our delinquencies and foreclosures are at a historic low right now. And in fact, we're among the lowest in the United States and have been for quite some time. We did not have the big foreclosure problem that some of the other states have had in recent past. In general, the funding that we get from the federal government, primarily HUD, for public housing funds is increasing. Even if you don't consider the additional money that we got from COVID relief, our base funding from public housing has been increasing slowly. One other thing that I wanted to mention is that many years ago, the legislature gave us the authority to create subsidiary corporation for the purposes of developing affordable housing in Alaska. And we have a project currently underway in Fairbanks that is began construction in July 2022. And we have 18 units of senior housing that are going up in the kind of in the center of Fairbanks. And another 40 units of family housing that will be under construction this summer in South Fairbanks. Both projects will be completed by the summer of 2024. And the name of our subsidiary corporation is the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing. Those are the two projects that that we have underway right now. The Corporation for Affordable Housing has done a couple of other projects in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, several years ago. Slide five. Before I go on and talk a little bit more about the programs that AHFC operates, I wanted to spend a moment kind of defining the term affordable housing as we use it at Alaska Housing. The federal government, in particular HUD, for many, many years, in fact, since 1937, has defined affordability, at least on the rental in the rental market, as a household not paying more than 30% of their gross income on monthly payments, including utilities. And as one would expect, there's an inverse relationship between affordability and income. Housing gets more affordable as your income goes up and less affordable as your income goes down. When we talk about affordable housing, there's many kind of different categories. Generally, it's the population of households at 80% of the median or below. And then there are deeper assistance levels targeting families at 50% of median and below. 50% of the median and below is generally referred to as very low income in HUD speak. Sometimes you'll also see a very, very low income targets at 30% of the median income. In general, in Alaska, the crossover point between where or at what point you start paying more than 30% of your income for rent is roughly about 60% of the median income. And I have some, for instance, as an example, in Alaska, 60% of the median income is $61,200 for a family of four. So families at that level tend to start pay more than 30% of their income for rent. Last year, it was estimated that in Fairbanks or in Anchorage, I was born and raised in Fairbanks, and I tend to revert back to my younger days as a parent to Fairbanks. But in any case, last year it was estimated that in Anchorage, about 20% of the households pay more than 50% of their rent for that year. Slide number six. So as we talk about affordable housing at Alaska Housing, we have a number of different programs that we administer, both on the federal and the state side, for the development or weatherization and rehabilitation of housing. I'm not going to go through all the lists here and talk in any detail. Some of them are tax programs, and they're not particularly exciting to get into too much detail, but we'd be happy to provide any level of detail on any of these programs that the committee would like at a later date. I do want to mention specifically under the state side, the Supplemental Housing Development Program, because I know that Chris Kolarek will probably be talking about that a little bit later. That is a housing development program that is funded from corporate receipts that we use in partnership with the regional housing authorities to extend the reach of their programs that are funded through the federal government out to the rural areas of Alaska. These are the main affordable housing programs we have for development in the corporation. Some of these, or most of them, you'll see in our operating budget, our capital budget requests that we provide every year. The picture here is just a photo of some of the residents of a project that we manage in Fairbanks called Birch Park. In addition to these programs, and I guess I should back up and say these are kind of the regular programs that the corporation administers on an annual basis. Funding can change periodically from year to year, but these are the core programs. With the federal response to the economic impact of COVID, HSC received some additional funding that got a lot of use in the state to address some of the issues related to eviction and foreclosure. If you could turn to slide 7. You will see that corporation received a number of additional programs for which we received authority through the legislature to spend these funds. The first one is the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which was the largest program, and that was $370 million. We also received contributions from the Municipality of Anchorage and the 14 regional housing authorities, representing a huge percentage of not only the tribes in Alaska, but the general population as a whole. We managed the front end portal for all of these different organizations so that we could have a coordinated approach so that we were able to reduce or potentially eliminate the potential for people to be double dipping or triple dipping into various programs. In addition to the COVID response program on the rental side, we also received $50 million under the Homeowner Assistance Fund, which was designed to address people who were in arrearages on their mortgage or other types of payments related to homeownership. And that's probably the last one on the list here was a special voucher program, the Emergency Housing Voucher Program. We received 194 vouchers from HUD for that program, and those vouchers were evenly split between Anchorage and the balance of state. We worked very closely with the Anchorage Coalition and Homelessness and the state coalition to split those vouchers out and make sure that they were used throughout the state. Slide number 8. I'm giving you a little bit more detail about the rental assistance program. We're extremely proud of the work that we did on this program in terms of coordinating all of the partners around the state, making sure that it was seamless for the tenants that applied as possible. To date, we've spent $262 million provided that to 11,000 different landlords on behalf of the 26,000 households that they were renting to. The first thing that we did was address the arrearages that if they existed for any of the clients, and then went forward in 3 month subsequent periods. It was a very successful program. We worked very closely with the housing authorities, the municipality of Anchorage, and I think that in general it was an extremely successful program and people got assistance very quickly, and it helped maintain a very low eviction rate in the state over the last couple of years. In the last bullet on here in terms of the housing stabilization program, there was some money left over under the rental assistance program, and we were able to create a unique and innovative program to help individuals that were homeless, 80% of which were sleeping in their cars or living outside of a shelter or in a shelter. Those 1,800 households that we were able to help got stable housing and moved from a substantially less desirable living condition into permanent or to temporary housing. So we were able to take those funds and redirect them once we had satisfied all of the folks that had applied under the rental assistance program. There is some additional money that's available that we're going to be using in the future for to supplement some of the rental development activities that we do under the programs that I mentioned before, our affordable housing programs. And we're looking forward to being able to make that money available so that we can build stock on the state. Turn to slide number 9. So I mentioned the homeowner assistance, a little bit more detail on that. Again, it was $50 million in total. It provided 3 months of mortgage payments for borrowers who were current on the loan and then also reinstated borrowers who were delinquent. We were able to, today we've been able to serve about 7,100 folks, and we've got about another 500 in the pipeline who are working through the process with their servicer. We did not, with the rental assistance program, we did not pay the mortgage holders directly. We worked with banks that were the servicers of those mortgages to provide the assistance directly to the servicer on behalf of the homeowner. Slide number 10. So I want to give you an idea of some of the things that the types of data collection and monitoring of the housing market that AHFC does on an annual basis to kind of guide the way that we approach housing policy and programmatic decisions as we look at whether we should change the direction of a specific program. Overall, our primary concern is to ensure that we don't overdevelop in a particular area and affect private sector housing market. You know, many of the markets in Alaska are relatively small, and you know, certain overdeveloping in one area could have a detrimental impact on the private sector landlords. And so we're extremely cautious about what we do. And as a result of that philosophy, we look at a couple of different things. Probably the most significant one is that we have a contract with the Alaska Department of Labor Research and Analysis Section to do annual rental market surveys. And you may have seen some of the information in the press about vacancy rates. That information comes from the work that we do with the Department of Labor. We do a quarterly survey of lenders to monitor what's happening in the mortgage market. Dan Robinson and his team over at Research Analysis have worked with us for a very long time, and they provide some additional data for us so that we can kind of keep a look at what's happening in the housing market, not just in the affordable market where we normally are operating, but in the general selling market as well, so that we make sure we stay in tune with what's happening in the private sector. In addition to that research, we also do market studies on every single development that we finance through our affordable programs, partly because it's a federal requirement to make sure that we don't overbuild in a specific community. But it makes it, we have a third-party market study firm review each individual project to see how it will fit in a specific market around the state. We also monitor the development operating costs of these properties and make sure that each year we're not we're staying consistent with what costs are, and that the development costs and operating costs of these projects stay within the normal range for these types of projects throughout the state. Granted, there are lots of regional variations in both development costs and operating costs, and we monitor those to make sure that we're being as accurate as we can. Once the property is up and running, we have a lot of information that comes from these properties in terms of occupancy data. We also have incentivized over the past number of years energy conservation and energy efficient construction with these projects, and so we also maintain information about how they're performing and which types of systems are working well and producing the results that were intended. As an aside, we also have done housing needs assessments roughly every 5 years for the last 20 or so, taking a pulse on what's happening in the housing market. Our Department of the Corporation is in charge of that, and in addition maintains our energy database of energy ratings throughout the state, and that's a very useful database in terms of what is happening with the new construction and rehabilitation projects around the state, both on the single family and the multifamily side. Next slide. So turning now to a little bit of a bit more of a discussion about the housing market in general, I think, you know, everyone at this point should know that, to use the phrase, things are tight all over. Both on the rental side, we have relatively low vacancy rates, as not only in the recent memory but historically. The vacancy rates in 2022 were lower than the 10-year average, and this information also comes from our contract with the Department of Labor, the research that they do for us. We've seen multiple rent increases in the last couple of years, sometimes within the same year. It looks like it might be trending to a more stable kind of rent increase environment over the last couple of months, and into next year. One thing that you may have heard a lot of conversation about, and that is the impact of short-term vacation rentals in the rental market. We're not sure exactly what the impact is, other than the general understanding that if you take property off the market, it creates a tighter rental market for those that are looking for a place to live. We have seen a number of different estimates about the number of Airbnb and short-term rental in Alaska. I think the numbers are kind of all over the place, but I think it generally everyone agrees that there's been a massive explosion in the last 8 years on the Airbnb and short-term rental front, and particularly in those areas of the state where we see a lot of visitors, both independent travelers and people coming up on the cruise lines. On the homeownership side, interest rates are probably the biggest thing that we're seeing in terms of impacts. It's cooled the market off a little bit in terms of sales, and I think that's borne out by all of the information that comes from the Alaska Association of Realtors. And understandably, interest rates have been higher than they have been in the recent past, and that's making people hold off selling their home. Interest rates, as interest rates rise, you know, it's harder to sell the house for the price that you might have been able to get for a couple of years ago. And it incentivizes people to stay in their homes, which also makes it a little bit difficult for renters who are trying to move up out of the rental pool. And so it kind of makes things a little bit more stuck, as in general. So interest rates in the homeownership market also can potentially have impact in the rental market as well. I think as many builders know, building costs are still high. We do see some supply chain improvements, you know, over the last year or so. But they still, construction costs in Alaska are very high. And I know that there's going to be some more information from some of the other presenters with more specificity on those particular issues. Again, short-term rentals are having an impact here as well for people that are trying to buy a house if they're being held off the market in order to rent them out. In general, I think, you know, and this comes from our housing needs assessments over time, as well as other information that we have. Overcrowding still exists, particularly in the rural areas. We generally have an aging housing stock across the board in Alaska, and particularly in rural Alaska, new development is very expensive and very challenging in terms of working with the logistics of getting materials out to those sites, as well as dealing with the different soil conditions and all the other challenges that people have in rural Alaska in terms of development. One of the things that I didn't necessarily want to end on a depressing note, we have seen a lot, even with all these challenges, you know, including population changes that we've seen, there is a lot of things that are going on. People across the state are, you know, have really worked very hard to try to figure out ways to address some of the issues in terms of lack of supply. You know, the Alaska Municipal League has a housing task force now, and they're meeting, they met regularly during the AML this year, and I know that people across the state have been sharing best practices at the local and municipal level on zoning and permitting and other financial support that localities can provide to the private sector in order to get more private sector development going around the state. I think everybody has probably heard about the increase in activity around the accessory dwelling units or the ADUs, and that looks like it's going to help substantially in some areas where people are building the mother-in-law apartments on their lots in order to provide additional rental space and or accommodate the needs of a family member. I think that if I could leave you with anything, I think the biggest challenge that we have is figuring out a way to assist the private sector in housing development. The nonprofit community can't do everything, and there's not enough nonprofit housing developers to even try. And so I think that's an important thing for all of us to try to work on, is to figure out how to get the private sector, make housing feasible for the private sector to start building again, and or in greater numbers than they are now. And then my last slide is slide 12, which is just a summary slide an opportunity to take any questions and answers. The folks that are listed or shown here on the graph are just like examples of the different families that the corporation has worked with a variety of programs, from our housing stabilization program for the homeless to, you know, our home ownership program. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions over until the other presentations are done and answer questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Romick. We're going to take questions in just a second. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Sadler arrived at 3:17 p.m., and Representative Gray has been with us in the room, and I would invite him to come up and sit down at the mic and participate as a non-voting participant to be recognized for questions if he would so choose. Oh. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If we're going to questions now, I do have a question for Mr. Romick. Through the chair, Mr. Romick, I represent downtown Anchorage, and a lot of our vacant or lots with parking lots in downtown seem to have either aging utilities or potentially contamination as an impediment to development. And I'm curious if AHFC has looked at using some of its funds that recently it's been returning to the legislature to try to remediate what are basically those public costs and enable private sector development of either undeveloped or underdeveloped lots in downtown Anchorage. If you haven't looked at that, what can we do to help encourage you to look at that as an option to spur more development downtown? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, right now, so Alaska, we have been involved in a number of different projects where there's been remediation of ground contamination for the projects, and those are generally eligible expenses for grant or financing. It obviously it raises the cost substantially, and so the question is usually, you know, how expensive does that make the entire project to develop? So we have we do work in that area, and in fact, we have a project that we developed ourselves that was a vacant lot that had a substantial amount of remediation that needed to be done, and we're fortunate enough to have some access to funds that were designed specifically for that. There are a couple of other federal programs that I know that the municipality of Anchorage has been using to look at some of the sites downtown, and so I think, you know, there are avenues for that, and particularly since they're eligible expenses for most project developments. Again, they limit the types of work that can be done because they get very expensive. And I know that, as an aside, there's been a lot of interest in addressing the surface parking, some of the surface parking in Anchorage as potential development sites. And as you probably are aware, Corporation currently owns Block 102 downtown Anchorage, which is currently a parking lot. And we've been in conversations for many years with the municipality about trying to do something with that particular parking lot.
Representative Carrick.
Actually, could I ask a follow-up on that?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to limit to one follow-up question so that we do have four presenters, and that way everyone can get a chance to. So, go ahead.
In the interest of time, Mr. Romick, maybe you could just let me know the status of that particular lot and don't need to take the committee's time with it right now. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Carrick.
Yeah, through the chair to Mr. Romick, I have a few questions. I'll just ask one. So I'm talked with contractors in my district, and it seems like for the private sector, one of the biggest drivers of cost is the cost of supplies, particularly lumber. For construction. So I'm just wondering if you can opine a little bit about building materials costs as a factor that's driving inability for private sector development as well as public sector.
Well, certainly, through the chair, Representative Carrick, I think that as I alluded to earlier, I think that over the last couple of years, building supplies and material costs have been extremely high. Historically, but of late, we haven't heard as much from some of the builders about not being able to get supplies. Whereas before, I think in the last couple of years, it was not only a cost, but also availability. I think it's now moving just towards cost. That's probably as much as I can opine with any real certainty. I think that there's somebody from the building association that's going to be on the panel as well, and he's probably far more qualified. Eric Visser is going to will probably be, well, I know for certain he'll be far more qualified than I would be to talk to you about a supply costs.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To the chair, Mr. Romick, I get one question. I'm going to load it up as much as I can. The you said there's about $370 million in emergency COVID rental assistance that came into our state. That's going to be a market distortion, both beneficial and detrimental to renters and landlords alike. So I guess, opine, if you would please, a little bit about the short-term and long-term effects of that emergency COVID money to the housing market in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Tadler, thank you for that question. That is a very good question, and I'm not sure that I have a definitive answer. I am a recovering economist, so I could give you an extremely long-winded answer, but I won't. I guess the short-term short-term impact is that all the landlords that were facing the eviction moratorium and the potential loss of a substantial amount of rent were made whole. And so in that sense, it was the short term was substantially positive, and I think it kept the housing market moving along without too much of a distortion. In the long run, I'm not sure that we really understand what the impact is going to be fully. It will completely depend on whether those tenants that were the landlords that were recipient of the funds on behalf of their tenants, those tenants stay in the property, got jobs, and then continue to pay the rent, or whether they're asked to leave because they can't for whatever reason come up with the rent in order to continue residing there. So I think the short-term impact is a lot clearer than what the long-term impact is going to be.
Representative Gray.
Hi, thank you. Through the chair, I have a question about AHFC in general and sort of the structure of, you do a lot of work to help people who can't afford housing, but you, what's the structure in terms of being able to contribute $23.4 million to the state of Alaska? You make money, but you also help, and can you just explain how that works? Thank you.
AHFC earns income through, the interest on its investments, as well as the mortgage interest revenue from, buying mortgages and receiving the interest payments on those. From that income, we generate enough money to pay for our operations. We're self-supporting, and there's no general fund money that goes into the operations of Alaska Housing. Without getting into too much detail, the dividend that we provide each year comes from a calculation that is set in statute that created a formula for us to use to determine what is an appropriate amount to provide to the state as a dividend each year. And in FY23, based on the earnings that we have in the corporation, that amount is roughly $23 million. And so, yes, Alaska Housing earns income and makes money off of the mortgages that we invest in and the other investments that we put our short-term cash in. And so that's how the dividend is generated. Did I get your question?
That does. And so it's the statute that states that we can't use that $23.5 million to help homeless people, for example. Like, I just want to be clear, like, the statute dictates that you must provide that dividend.
The chair, Representative Gray, dividend shows up in our capital budget and is used to fund the wide variety of capital projects that you as a legislature review each year. One of those is a fairly significant program called the Homeless Assistance Program. And that program has been funded for decades by the legislature upon request from Alaska Housing and submission by the governor. So the dividend goes back to the state in the form of our capital projects, and if there is any excess left after funding our capital projects or other projects, then that reverts to the state.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has grown into other things over the decades. It used to be primarily, well, I think only, financing, and now you've gotten into more programs. Roughly how much of your business is now oriented towards financing others to build things as opposed to managing and managing grants and managing subsidies?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, I'm not sure that I could give you a very specific answer right now. We'd certainly get back to you with a more precise distribution, but all of our mortgage activity is essentially financing of other folks, whether it be single family or multifamily financing, or the special odd loan that we do, like the military loans that we've done for housing in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. So that's, I can say that with certainty, that's probably the lion's share of our business. We have programs that we manage because we're under contract with the federal government to manage those programs, the public housing, Section 8, those programs. And so that program alone, as I alluded to earlier, the federal portion of our budget, which includes managing the funds that we get from the federal government for those two programs, is roughly about 70% of our operation. The other 30% is the management of corporate funds, corporate programs, and our mortgage programs, and our other financing activities.
Okay. Representative Wright.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for answering the question about the homeless assistance program. I really would like to follow up with you later on about that offline, but one of my questions is, only question I'll have since we don't have a lot of time. The vouchers, the emergency homelessness vouchers that you talked about, that you work with ACH, how many vouchers did you give out last year, and who decides, what's the criteria?
I'm through the chair, Representative Wright. For the emergency housing voucher program, the requirement that came with those vouchers from HUD was that we work directly with the two coalitions, the continuum of care. And that's the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness in Anchorage, and the state coalition, the Alaska Council to End Homeless, I believe. So we work with them directly to figure out a split of where those vouchers would go, and that's where the decisions come between 50-50, 50% for Anchorage and 50% for the balance of state. At the balance of state, the assignment or the selection of individuals to receive those vouchers came through the staff. Brian Wilson runs the Balance of State Coalition, and the Anchorage Coalition is run by Meg Zelda.
Thank you.
Sorry, I believe I missed Representative Prox had a follow-up question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, let me ask the question a little bit different way. How much of the market share of the housing finance market and how much of the property management share does AHFC control at this point? And is it growing or shrinking?
Thank you for that. Through the chair, Representative Prax, AHFC's market share of the mortgages purchased or maintained in Alaska is roughly about 20%. And it's been relatively stable for a long period of time. Many might remember back in the 80s and the 90s, the corporation had a substantial share of the mortgage market, much more than 50%, which we do not believe was a healthy percentage for the corporation or for the state. So it's gone down substantially since then and has been maintained roughly around 20% for a number of years. In terms of the share of property management, we only manage our own properties, and that's about 1,600 units in the state. I think there's roughly, you know, there's several hundred thousand rental units in the state as a whole, so our percentage is relatively small.
Good to know. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Romick. So as many people listening online and in the room know, buying a house and all of that can be a stressful, time-intensive process. What is the length of time for an individual or a family who is wanting to use AHFC to aid or help them in the mortgage process to go through the whole thing, so to speak, from start to finish to being in a home? What's the average time that a family might spend on that process?
Through the chair, Senator Representative Ruffridge, you know, I don't know the exact number of days. I know that we have improved the turnaround time on our mortgage application substantially over the last couple of years. We've moved to automated underwriting and automated interest rate lock-ins. And so I'll have to get back to you with a specific time on what that is. I bet I know that it's substantially been reduced.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Romick. We're going to move along, and we've got Eric Visser, president of the Alaska Homebuilders Association, next. Mr. Visser, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm great. Thank you, guys. Good afternoon, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. It's an honor to be here today and speak on behalf of the Alaska State Homebuilders Association. I'm Eric Visser. I'm a builder in Anchorage and president of ASHPA. ASHPA is a statewide organization that serves the needs of the residential construction industry. Our mission is to provide a platform for building contractors and other housing-related trades, industries, and professions to come together and discuss common problems and issues. Our goal is to maintain a high standard in the building industry and reduce the risk for building contractors, encourage sound business practices, all while offering practical solutions for the challenges that face our industry. By bringing members together, we provide a forum for discussion and collaboration, and we aim to support growth and success of our industry, as well as create new, efficient, and attainable homes in the communities that we work. As president of HBA, I have the privilege of leading an organization that's run by and for its membership. Our membership consists of over 411 companies, made up of home building firms, subcontractors, and service providers that all make up the residential construction industry. Our membership is supported by six local home building associations in Fairbanks, Matsu, Anchorage, Kenai, Juneau, and the Ketchikan areas. In addition to the statewide support offered by ASHPA, our members benefit from the advocacy provided by the National Association of the Home Builders on the federal level. ASHPA provides the advocacy on the state level, and the associations focus on community-level advocacy on codes, ordinances, and local regulations. One of our main focuses as an organization is to advocate for our members, monitor statutes and regulations, and the budgets that impact our industry. We're committed to addressing key issues like adoption of a statewide building code, enforcement of contractor licensing and workers' compensation insurance, sufficient funding for programs like the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, the AHSC Weatherization Program, and workforce development programs that increase access to labor force for the residential industry is also critical. Another important focus for ASHPA is education in the industry. Alaska contractors that work on housing must have a residential endorsement for their contractor's license. ASHPA provides continuing education each year that's required to renew your license and endorsement. We're a strong advocate for the importance of education in the residential construction industry, and we're committed to ensuring that our members have access to the resources that they need. Cash was a vital part of the economic landscape in the state. Our members contribute significantly to the growth and development of the state's economy or the community that they work. Mark touched a little bit on the housing assessments that AHFC does, but I just want to touch on a couple of those points. Their last housing assessment that they did in 2018 projected the shortfall of about 16,000 housing units at that time. The projections were showing that by 2025, we were needing about 25,000 new housing units. And just to put that perspective, in 2018, Alaska had about 303,000 housing units in the state. Of those units, about 14,000 of them were considered inefficient, which they had a one-star rating in the ACWARM program, if you guys are familiar with that. He also touched on the cost-burdened households in Alaska. That totaled about 31% back in 2018. So these statistics really underscore the importance of the work being done by the ASHBA membership. And just in conclusion, the Alaska State Home Builders Association is a valuable resource for builders and remodelers in state. Our mission is to provide support and advocate for our memberships and ensure that homeowners have quality and affordable housing. I'm proud to be a member of this organization and committed to leading it in a direction that benefits our members. And just to touch on a couple of the questions that had came up earlier, if I may, I think in terms of the building materials costs, over the past year, they have definitely come down significantly. A lot of people were paying attention to lumber prices during the pandemic and, you know, shortly after that. As of March of 22, the cost for a board feet of lumber, which is kind of how we measure the general cost of lumber, was up around $1,400. As of the first of this month, it came down to around, I think it's like right around $500 per 1,000 board feet. So it's come down a pretty substantial amount, but that really doesn't address all the other items that are still, you know, raised quite a bit during the pandemic, 20, 30, 40% for things like sheetrock and insulation and all of these other little items that, you know, really kind of just nickel and dime us and, you know, prevent us from providing a lot of this affordable housing that we need. So with that, I thank you for your guys' time, and I'm open to any more questions you may have.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bisser, thanks for your presentation. And one of our mandates here on this committee is workforce. So kind of setting aside a bit some of the particular home builders' concerns for the market, what's the situation for your members in hiring people to do the work that you like to do? And if you have any suggestions on how to address the situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, so one of the things we definitely struggle with hiring the proper amount of labor. I think a lot of the home builders in the state could build a lot more houses if they had the labor force to support that. Some of the ideas that we're kicking around are being able to get into schools, you know, high schools and earlier, and show students that, you know, they have a great career in the residential construction industry. We don't have that ability right now because we struggle with things like workers' compensation insurance, where we can't hire, you know, kids under 18 to, you know, work on our job sites. So a lot of the smaller contractors that are doing the residential construction lose out on the opportunity to get in with these kids early. So providing solutions for that would be one of the good first steps.
Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, are you involved in the housing situation discussion in the Fairbanks North Star Borough?
Through the chair, no, I'm not.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, if the legislator wanted to somehow create the environment for a housing construction explosion in the state of Alaska, what would be the best way to go about doing that?
Yeah, through the chair, you know, there's unfortunately no magic wand that we can wave that will all of a sudden increase development and, you know, single family construction. Some of the things that we have been talking about are bringing back programs like the energy rebate program that provide an incentive for new construction to, you know, build more efficiently. It definitely, you know, moves the needle a little bit, kind of will spur people to get off the couch a little bit and, you know, go after a new construction home if they have the ability to go after, you know, say $5,000 or $10,000 in an energy rebate. But then I know there's other bigger developments that are coming through, like I think it was the Alaska Housing Trust or Housing Alaska as it's called now, where, you know, you create one entity that has the ability to go after, you know, develop all these public private partnerships and go after tax credits that then can, you know, they can team up with smaller developers and smaller home builders to create more housing.
And Representative Sadler had a follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Bisser, I was going to ask you a question about whether the smaller mother-in-laws or auxiliary dwelling units or something is something that could help address our statewide shortage of housing. But realizing probably a better question is, what are the limitations, directives, codes, standards, et cetera? What are the parameters under which home builders in Alaska have to operate?
Through the chair, more specifically related to the things like ADUs, I'm very supportive of movements like that. I think one of the challenges that everybody faces when talking about ADU construction is that we don't have any mechanisms in place to allow people to build them without coming out of a huge amount of money out of their pocket. So if, you know, creating more or better financing terms or financing programs that allow people to build additional units on their existing lots without having to come up with a huge amount of money out of pocket would spur some of that development.
Okay.
Representative Prox for a follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair, have you looked at the locally graded lumber initiative or, I guess, bill that I think the administration is considering introducing?
Yeah, through the chair, I definitely heard a lot about it. I think it's pretty exciting for Alaska. That's more so, it would be have a bigger impact in rural Alaska than I think it would in urban areas, Anchorage in the past too. But I think it would definitely be a beneficial program for the state if we're allowed that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Mr. Visser, and thank you through the chair. Just a question on ADU construction. Again, that seems to be a big topic. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that a lot of that, the rules and regulations for that is held at the municipal level. Is there an action for the state legislature there that you would foresee, or is most of that being driven at a local level?
Through the chair, I think most of it's being driven at the local level. I'm fairly certain the state of Oregon passed a bill that allowed accessory dwelling units on any zoning by right, but I haven't seen of anything or heard of anybody wanting to bring that to the state level yet.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Visser. We're going to move on to Todd McManus, Alaska Bankers Association. Mr. McManus, are you on with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Representative Sumner and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Appreciate you having me on here to give a little background from the Alaska Bankers Association point of view. This is an important topic. We discuss it a lot, and I think it's great that we are bringing it to the state level. So my name is Todd McManus, as you heard. I'm currently the president of First Bank. We're in Southeast Alaska. Looking at your committee membership there, I don't know that we have any Southeast folks with us, but if you're not familiar with us, we have 8 branches, been around for just under 100 years, and we operate only in the Southeast region. I'm also currently the president of the Alaska Bankers Association, and that's who I'm here representing today. Our association is comprised of the 7 banks who have physical locations in the state. Together, we have over 2,200 professional, hardworking employees. And we have combined
Mr. McManus, would it be possible for you to speak up a little bit or speak closer to the phone?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure what you caught there, but I was saying we have combined, we have about 2,200 employees throughout the state, hardworking employees, professionals that are working to protect the financial interests of Alaskans. Our member banks combined safeguard roughly $17 billion in Alaskan deposits, and we currently provide roughly 85% of the private non-public lending in the state. So housing is a big part of what we do every day as far as mortgage banking, working on the flow of money from tenants to landlords, potential owners to contractors, all of the things that you would use financial services and banks for. The banks, in general, our banking sector is healthy when our economy is healthy. And to have a healthy economy, you need places for people to live, schools that are good, jobs to be had. So we are in favor of any policies, any initiatives that can create sustainable, equitable housing that can support the workforce that's coming into our state or to keep the workforce here in our state. We work, Alaska Housing was a big part of this presentation. We work very closely with Alaska Housing primarily through our mortgage banking activities. They're a great partner for the state, and it's a resource that if the state didn't have, there would be massive amounts of loan deserts, I guess, out there because the federal programs, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, don't necessarily touch some of our rural areas in the state, and they have requirements that exclude certain areas just based on the maybe the road system access or fire access or remoteness of the properties. Another important point about the bankers is all of those 2,200 people that I mentioned live and work in the communities in Alaska. So it's not only important for us to support the regions we're in, but these are people who are living here, raising their own children in our communities, and it's important to all of us to see that we have housing available for children to grow up and move into, right, so we can keep them in the state. As far as the housing, I can speak, to a couple things that I'm seeing in our area, Southeast Alaska. It's not only an affordable housing problem, but it's an availability of housing problem. So in Southeast Alaska, we're surrounded by national forest, and access to land is a big issue for our developers, people who want to build new housing stock. So I guess if there was any takeaway there, any initiatives or efforts the state can make to open up tracts of land and encourage development would be appreciated because there's very limited quantities of private land in throughout the state. Another sort of tangential to that, we have not only an issue of people looking for single family housing, which has been the primary focus of this conversation, but we have a great need for workforce housing in Southeast Alaska. As you know, it's a tourism-based economy these days, and with that comes an influx
summertime, and we are hearing from our tour operators and retail businesses in the region that they're having trouble getting workers into town for the summer because the people coming in can't find anywhere to live for that 3, 4, or 5 months. So there's a need for, for lack of a better term, group housing as well, or larger types of housing, multifamily, even short-term type housing. We have an influx of 3,000 to 5,000 people just in Ketchikan in the summertime that can come in on working, but fishing and tourism, and with some of the summer construction work that happens here. I guess I'll wrap it up just by saying that the banking sector is healthy. We have ample capital, ample liquidity. We are here wanting to finance housing projects and encourage development, and we're able to, and we just need the private sector to be supported with regulations that allow them to move forward, and available land to do it on. William, take any questions.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I am wondering, with you mentioned federal programs and support, and I think AHFC provides quite a lot of support for housing in rural Alaska. I'm wondering, do you know how much of Alaska or what percentage would qualify as a loan desert without those assistance programs?
Thanks for the question. I would probably defer to the gentleman from Alaska Housing. He would probably have a better idea about which areas of the state they are able to do mortgage lending in that typically not available through a Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae program. Just thinking off the top of my head, I know we have areas in Southeast Alaska that are rural in nature and don't have maybe road access to fly or boat in only, and those areas, for instance, would be excluded from traditional mortgage financing. It would need to go through like the rural program, Alaska Housing.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, you talked about the need to increase the workforce and to hang on to that workforce. And I'm curious if you have an idea for how the legislature might help to increase the workforce and hang on to that workforce.
That's a great question. Specifically to the building trade, there used to be, I think you have to start, as Mr. Visser was saying, you have to start early and try to get into the schools and get people interested in the trades again. There's sort of been a push for a long time away from trade school, a multitude of reasons, but we don't have as many opportunities in our schools, in our high schools anymore for trade type elective, and I think that would help. And then, you know, the state, you know, was running a pretty active construction academy for a while, and I think it was a partnership with Alaska Housing and the Home Builders Association. Those types of programs get people interested into the workforce. As far as the general workforce, all of the things we talked about, you have to have, you know, paying jobs, which the state already does, and then you have to have places for people to live, schools for their children to go to, you know,
Okay, thank you, Mr. McManus. We're going to move along to Chris Kolarok, AAHA Legislative Committee Chair and Director of Public Policy for Cook Inlet Housing Authority. Mr. Kolarok, if you're there, please correct my pronunciation of your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, you did just fine. For the record, my name is Chris Kolarok with Cook Inlet Housing Authority, and I'm the Legislative Committee Chair for the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities. Chair Sumner, Vice Chair Ruffridge, thank you for the members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to share a bit about the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities with you, or as we like to say, AHA for short. AHA is a membership organization of the 14 regional housing authorities across the state of Alaska. And we represent 196 tribes under the umbrella in a consortium style. The Association of Alaska Housing Authorities members were created by a state statute in 1971, specifically to go after pools of federal money at the Department of Housing and Urban Development that were not accessible by the Alaska State Housing Authority at the time, which later in the 80s merged with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Our members essentially geographically follow ANCSA lines because of the timing of our enabling statute. And our members essentially are the main providers and developers of affordable housing in rural Alaska. The association itself provides two main functions. It provides training and technical assistance so that these housing authorities are able to operate and maintain their essentially clean audits and learn new skills to bring new methods of building housing online. And our second is advocacy, which is in line with our enabling statute and Alaska statute. And part of that mandate is my talk with you today. If you could go to the next slide, please. Before I move on, I'm going to apologize. After 35 months, I finally got COVID. So if I get a little hoarse, I apologize. And also, there is a non-zero chance that my three-year-old will burst into my office at home because, well, that's what she did when I was presenting to the Unitarians. And that was quite a fun presentation there. So regional housing authorities, essentially, we develop affordable housing and those are, we can do that, you know, when you talk about affordable housing development, we talk about the shell and the internals of a house or an apartment. What is often missed in discussions about housing development is all the other things that are not immediately related to the shell. And by that, I mean the water and sewer connections, the electrical connections to the grid, roads to the site, and the actual foundations. We construct about 185 homes on average every year, and we are required with our grant source from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to build to the Alaska Building Energy Efficiency Standards. Essentially, we are building five-star, five-and-a-half-plus to six-star homes for the health of our residents and also for the conservation of energy. And off-the-road system energy is incredibly expensive. If you go to the next slide, we also preserve housing stock through rehabilitation and in particular weatherization, which is a sub-grant from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and partially a pass-through from the Department of Energy through AHFC. And I'm going to spend 1 minute on this. Most of the homes in Alaska were built in the 1970s and 80s, which is no surprise. That's when our population boomed, and that's when our finances boomed. And what is a surprise mentally is that the 70s and 80s were 50 and 40 years ago. And then even earlier, in general, when you have a system and anything that's 50, 60 years old, it just doesn't work like it used to when you first built it. To that end, our members rehabilitated about 1,350 homes and weatherized about 100. You can go on to the next slide. We've got, in addition to the hard work that we do, and by that I mean pounding nails and driving screws, our members engage in soft skills as well, with financial literacy for potential residents, home buyer readiness classes, and even home buyer safety programs, all the things that skills that you need to learn prior to really owning a home. In many ways, AHFC's soft skills classes, but tailored to our specific residents. Next slide. I'm going to talk a bit about the economic importance of regional housing authorities. And in fact, we can go on to slide 7. I think our the economic benefit of the regional housing authorities is quite large to the state. 90% of our spending is within the state of Alaska, including indirect, direct, and induced spending. The McDowell Group has estimated that. Well, that's because I'm a little bit old. McKinley Research has estimated that total to be about $228 million. And in the next few years, we have at least $157 million planned on construction, maintenance, rehab, and other housing programs. What this dollar figure means, if you move to the next slide, is quite a bit of payroll. Our work supports 1,280 Alaskan jobs, totaling about $90 million in payroll. Approximately half of the housing authorities in rural Alaska utilize a forced account construction method, which means they don't bid it out. They actually are in charge of the work themselves. They hire and train their workers. The other half put out an RFP or RFI for bidding. And in addition, about three quarters of our housing authorities participate in the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Teacher, Health Professional, Public Safety Housing Development Program. Which is a program that is essentially a loan and leveraging program combined with small amounts of grant funding to develop homes for essential workers in small communities. I think we've heard quite a bit over the last few years of the lack of housing, and that doesn't just hit our urban areas or even just run-of-the-mill residents who need a home. But if we don't have housing for public safety officers or health professionals, they simply can't be in a place like EMARC and deliver those services that are needed. I'm going to go a bit into information here. If you go to the next slide, I'm going to talk a bit about our housing shortage. And quite a bit of this information is graciously taken from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's 2018 Housing Needs Assessment. If we go to slide 10, we know that there's a housing shortage, not just because people have been saying it over and over and we're sort of hearing it in casual conversation. We know because AHFC's published this very beautiful graph that shows us in regions of Alaska what overcrowding rates are. So if we look at the households in Chelistra region, YK Delta, we know that the overcrowding rate is almost 40%. So 40% of houses are overcrowded. And HUD divides that in two. They say just sort of run-of-the-mill overcrowding and then severe overcrowding. And there's actually more severe overcrowding than quote-unquote run-of-the-mill. Same with Nana, Bering Straits, Arctic Slope. Our rural regions are incredibly overcrowded, and that is a big indication that there is a massive shortage of housing. If you go to the next slide, we've heard this from Deputy Director Romick at AHFC, a bit from Eric Visser, but this is just graphically on slide 11. when houses were built. Now, the Seary region, which includes Anchorage, Nat-Su isn't in here, otherwise it would just dwarf the scale. But it follows the same pattern. Homes were built largely in the 70s, 80s, some in the 60s. But there is an incredible drop-off once we start getting into the latter 90s and into the 2000s. I'll talk a bit about why that is in a minute. But what that means visually, if you go to slide 12, is actually we can see an overcrowded house. I was previously the executive director of the Barren Straits Regional Housing Authority. This home is in one of our villages that I used to administer the housing program for. There are actually 14 people who share this home. Now, the housing shortage, if we take everything together, it's driven by either homes that fall into disrepair or homes there's just not enough construction activity in the first place. If we go to the next slide, part of the solution for that is one of the funding programs that is supported by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. It's called the Supplemental Housing Development Grant, which is an incredibly flexible grant. It's able to be used to develop new housing. It's able to rehabilitate existing housing. It's also able to construct water, sewer, electrical, roads, all the infrastructure that we sometimes is artfully forgotten when we discuss the total cost of housing. And one of the interesting pieces of the Supplemental Housing Development Grant is it's only 20% of a project cost. So we can't just say, AHFC, give us the Supplemental Housing Development Grant and it'll be the whole thing. We have to go out and marry it with other funding and make a leveraged project so that we have multiple sources in one use. I'm going to be a bit quick because I know I'm between you and the end of your day. Further proof of the housing shortage, maybe housing decrepitness. If you go on to slide 14, the percentage of homes with incomplete plumbing. Now, when the census asks about incomplete plumbing, it can mean maybe it doesn't have a shower, maybe it doesn't have a sink. But I think we all know that in rural, incomplete plumbing usually means it doesn't have a toilet. And we look at places like Southwest in the Chalice region or Bering Straits region, a third of homes without a flush toilet, 20% of homes without a flush toilet. That's a pretty big indicator that in 2022 there's a large scale deficiency in housing quality. I think what everyone might appreciate is on the next slide, in slide 15, is actually the percent of homes with a 1-star energy rating. If you think through a 1-star energy rating in the Alaska region, Southeast Alaska, typically we might say that's not terrible. It's sort of a temperate boreal rainforest. But then you start looking at the Otna region. You think 13% of homes in the Otna region have a 1-star energy rating. It gets really cold in the interior. Bering Straits, Nana, also very, very cold. The amount of heating fuel burned to combat a 1-star energy rating is pretty incredible. So that's one of the reasons why, if you go to the next slide, we're a big fan of weatherization. That weatherization preserves housing. If you have homes that are not weatherized and weather gets into that home, it's going to decay and degrade the quality of that housing. And if those homes become decrepit, as a thought experiment, if we take a home in an already overcrowded community and it falls into disrepair to uninhabitability, then every other home around it will be further overcrowded. And actually, just, you know, there's an actual relationship with the number of people breathing in a home that will decrease its useful life without some intervention like weatherization. Just like the Mona Lisa, just like works of art, your house is actually not made to take all the breath if you have 15 people in a 900 square foot home. I'm going to go a bit into the next skip two slides. To slide 18, quite a bit of this question comes up quite often, and it's why isn't there more housing? What's the barrier to more housing? Well, there's not more housing because housing is expensive. It's sort of an interesting experiment. Well, what's the problem with housing? Housing costs a lot of money. And I'll get into some of that reasoning here in just actually right now. If we go to slide 19. The three biggest cost drivers for regional housing authorities in particular, but for any residential construction, is labor, construction material, and logistics. Now I'm sharing some statistics prior to COVID because post COVID, I don't know if anyone wants to hang their hat on numbers post COVID. But prior to COVID, when things were quote unquote normal, construction labor over 20 years increased in cost by 56%, 70% for material, and 50% for water freight, 60% for air freight. The three biggest input factors for our rural residential construction program all had an incredible increase in cost. So why isn't there more housing? Well, because it's expensive and prices increased. And, you know, if we think through where our homes are off of the road system, the figure for transportation assuredly has to be underfigured. If you go to slide 20, we've got two pictures actually of material being unloaded in Savunga. There's no dock in Savunga. So what happens is all that material gets shipped from a supplier in Wasilla, which makes, from my experience, one of the best housing kits in the state, one of the most durable and energy efficient housing kits. That stuff gets on a barge in Anchorage, goes to Nome, transferred to a lighter, and then some brave soul gets into a loader and drives into the middle of the Bering, not the middle, but drives into the Bering Sea and unloads the housing kit, right? That's not cheap. That's incredibly expensive. Or if you think places that are landlocked, like Anaktuvuk Pass, they got to get a Linden Herc to unload it. And we all know that's not going to be cheap either. Slide 21 adds additional flavor to why housing is expensive. This is actually a picture of some work in Savunga that I had to authorize in my very first year as an executive director. This is infrastructure. This is a monolithic pad, a road extension, and the extension of a water and sewer system in the city of Savunga. These were all necessary because they didn't exist there. What we had to do and what we were faced with is at the last minute, we were told there's not enough roads. There's not enough, there's not the path that you want to be at are not strong enough. And the water system is fully capacitated. So you can either wait 5 years to hopefully all of these disparate organizations can get the money for a model pad, can get the BIA roads money, can get the IHS sanitation money, or you as the housing authority can just pay for it. And I had to sacrifice a house in order to get this stuff on a definite timeline. It hurt me quite a bit to make that choice, but I went for the sure thing rather than waiting for indeterminate growth. Then let's go to the next slide. Furthermore, on housing expenses, I like this picture here because it gets to some of the cost of housing. If you look at underneath the house, we've got some pretty beefy concrete piles, and we have some very beefy steel ivy. These are not at all cheap. And when you have a claim, people always are confused why housing is so expensive. Why do the regional housing authorities spend so much on a house? I can buy a kit for $185,000. Well, the kit is everything inside the six walls. The kit doesn't include the foundation. The kit doesn't include the site prep. The kit may or may not include ship. That's probably FOB to know. Not actual drop-off in Savunga. That's just a little bit of flavor of cost. some of the policy, if you go to the next slide, we know that in addition to overall the cost of construction, I'm going to shift a bit into the housing market in general. On slide 23, if you look, this is a complicated slide, but let's start here. In Alaska, the average home sold for $172,000 in 2000. If we track inflation from 2000 to 2001, the average home should have cost $266,000. That's the rule of inflation. There's a percentage. We apply it to the old cost. We bring it forward in time. Instead, the average home sold for $388,640. What that's telling us is the cost of homes around the state is higher than inflation. So remember that slide I showed you about inflation, about the impact? That's purely material. This slide is telling you, in addition to that, there's some other market issues happening that's increasing the cost of housing. Again, I'm saying this because housing's expensive. And if we go into the next slide, slide 24, you'll actually see that it's even worse than that. In the city of Anchorage, the average cost was actually higher than the statewide cost, even though the total loan volume was lower due to interest rates. That's what that graph said. So when we look at the year 2022, the number of loans is almost a third of what it was for the year before, but because of market power, because of, for whatever reason, the cost of homes was incredibly high. Now, I've said, okay, the cost of material is high, the cost of labor is high, the cost of logistics is high, the market prices are high. What's going on with our federal support for, let's just say, Indian housing? On slide 25, you'll see a graph showing the support for Indian housing, which is our primary driver for our regional housing authorities across the state. In 1999, our starting point was about $601 million. And until about 2020, we were getting on with $650 million. That means, according to the official numbers, we lost about a third of our purchasing power due to inflation. So there's a lot of input. There's a lot of reasons why there's not enough help. Slide 26 is actually a visual representation of this. Again, this is a slide. This is a village in Bering Straits Regional area. This is taken when I was the executive director there. There is a housing development from the 90s, 20 homes. In blue is a housing development from the early 2000s. That's 10 homes. And in black is a housing development that was constructed from 2015 to 2016, and that's 5 homes. This is literally showing the effects of the loss of the purchasing power from federal sources. And I'm only going to allude to the federal sources, but there is also due to fiscal issues, some loss of purchasing power from our state traditional sources as well. Let's see here. If we take a look, I'm going to skip slide 27, we'll go to slide 28. I'm going to chat a bit about homelessness, and I'm going to talk about it from an urban perspective. We have three of our members, Cook Inlet Housing Authority, Interior Regional Housing Authority, Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority, have urban areas, and homelessness is an incredibly touchy topic at the moment. So I'm going to spend the last few minutes talking about homelessness. Go to the next slide, slide 29. I just want to share with you, this is data from the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. And I'm showing this purely to show that we've got a lot of data. Data is being collected. It's incredibly complex. But there are some worrisome, I'm going to say some heartbreaking statistics. So Alaska Native population that are homeless in Anchorage, 46%. The population of homeless people in Anchorage is actually 40% that's white.
and black is 15%. This may surprise people if you're just used to associating what you see maybe on Benson Boulevard or what you see on Third Avenue versus the data, and that alludes to a problem of the visible versus invisible homeless. But the truly heartbreaking statistics are the fact that 18% of Anchorage's homeless population began being homeless before they were 18 years old. They were children. 38% are eligible to be trustees of the mental, or beneficiaries of the mental health trust, meaning they have an addiction issue, they're aged, they have dementia, or they have a mental health condition. And one of the worst is one of the worst statistics is that 22% of the people experiencing homelessness in Anchorage are people who experience domestic violence. So when we talk about homelessness, I want to remember the population that are under 18, the population that are fleeing domestic violence, purely because we sometimes get wrapped up in the visible homeless that sort of make our lives difficult day to day, but we forget the people, like, say, in the Awake shelter that are homeless. So going to slide 30, I'm going to share with you some a thought experiment. I want you to think back to the last time you got angry at something very trivial. For example, maybe you forgot how to change a set TV or your Roku remote. Or your phone is doing something that you don't expect. I want you to think about the irrational fear that you had at that. And maybe you were angry at yourself, or maybe you're angry at the world for changing, or something happened, but you're incredibly angry. And I want you to apply that to the entirety of your existence. And I'm going to say that as a setup to this. For people who are experiencing homelessness, they get better over time at being homeless. And that's because your brain has to create pathways. Neurological connections are created that make you better at what you're doing. Over time, I'm getting better at giving PowerPoints to the state legislature. Over time, my daughter is getting better at conning me out of M&Ms. Over time, people are getting better at being homeless. The skills that are required, the sort of sixth sense that is required, the attitude that is required, the automatic response to stimuli required to be homeless, does not work well with an immediate shoving into six walls. By that I mean, take someone who's very good at being homeless on the Chester Creek Trail and suddenly put them into an apartment, they're not going to be successful. We know this because we, in the year 2022, Cook Inlet Housing Authority has had $1 million in damage to our rental units from people who are exiting homelessness. So we know some things. We know that the solution to homelessness, if you go to the next slide, isn't just building a home. It's not the physical thing. We don't just take people and put them into six walls. That is a recipe for disaster. We know it financially because of our losses. We know it now intrinsically because when we think through, you've got to be, you know, the mental energy to being homeless doesn't translate into immediately turning off. If it took you years to become good at being homeless, it will take time to be good at living in a home. The solution to homelessness is housing plus. I apologize for the slide. Again, I've got COVID, and so some of these words are not going as well as I wanted them to, but we have to have interventions that are people focused. We have to have interventions that have services. We cannot build our way out of homelessness. We can social service our way out of homelessness, but we're never going to do it purely building things. The only way we're going to solve homelessness is with supportive services. And if you look at the nation's largest advocacy organization, National Low Income Housing Coalition, all of their data, all of their research on what is most effective in solving homelessness is social service interventions along with homes. So we're not going to build it. we have to social service our way out. Finally, I'm going to leave you with this thought. There are two ways of housing people. If you go to slide 32, the next one, there are two big, large buckets in housing, two big ways of thinking how to house people. The first way I'm going to call independent housing, and that's probably the way that you think about generally when you think about homes, housing, independent housing. You may need some support. You may need Meals on Wheels. You may have some kind of assistance. But generally, inside your home, you live independently. And we can think about that at Widener apartment homes, a home built by Spinel Homes or Visser Construction, even subsidized homes from like NeighborWorks or Cook Inlet Housing Authority, or senior homes like the Thomas Center behind St. Mary's at Lake Oaks and Tudor. These are independent homes. The assumption is that the provider of the home literally is just the provider of the home. The second big bucket is a supported house. And by supported housing, I mean somebody helps you live. And if we think about these on a big spectrum, it makes sense. If you think about a shelter like Anchorage Gospel Rescue Mission, or if you think of permanent supportive housing like Rural CAP or Volunteers of America, people have to help them live when they're living there. That's support. We can even apply this to our elders. Like, for example, my grandfather, who I am going to have to have a conversation with this spring about where he's going to live, either senior living facility or a nursing facility like Prestige Care. There is a large investment of someone's time into helping people live their daily life. So I bring that up because we can't solve homelessness with independent housing. We have to solve homelessness with supportive housing. I've got a few slides to visually make this point. If you look at slide 33, this is an affordable independent housing development, 1310 West 32nd Avenue. It's an apartment building. You move in, and inside your apartment, you're expected to live generally independently. If you need Meals on Wheels to drop off meals, that's one thing. If you need anchor rides to provide you a ride to your doctor's appointment, that's one thing. But we don't expect to enter your home to help you live your daily life. Next slide, slide 34, just further examples of independent housing. Slide 35, again, independent senior housing. That's the Bering Straits Regional Housing Authority, senior apartments in Nome. When we get to slide 36, you start seeing what supported housing looks like. It looks like shelter. Covenant House Alaska is a supported housing place. It is both a shelter and it has longer-term transitional housing. People are invested daily into assisting people there, residents. People that are expensive, clinicians, case managers, navigators, people there for safety, for food service. This is a different kind of housing, and it is a homelessness intervention. Slide 37, just another view of supported housing. Slide 38, again, more supported housing. You take, you know, slide 38 is Brother Francis Shelter and the Abused Women's Aid in Crisis Shelter. These are places where people are helping day to day someone lives. That difference between independent housing and supported housing is incredibly important. We can't have a solution to homelessness come from independent housing. So that's been quite a bit. I'll leave you on slide 39, a thank you and a farewell from one of the commissioners from the Interior Regional Authority named Speedy Sam. He's a Marine Corps veteran and a very conscientious commissioner for that housing authority. Finally, my contact information is on slide 40. This was a bit compressed, but I'm available. Feel free to email me, and I'm open to any questions. again, Chair Sumner, Vice Chair Ruffridge, thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Mr. Klarok. We got a little bit of time for questions. Does anybody have any? Representative Gray.
Hey, thank you so much. Through the chair, Mr. Klarok, can you talk about Atna? I noticed on the slide that Atna had no homes built in the 2000s, which that kind of leapt out at me. It seems that Chilista and Nana have the most need, but I just was curious about what's happening in Atna.
Through the chair, yeah, Representative Gray, Atna is an incredibly small region. Partially, this is probably driven largely through their requirements to sort of save up some of their capital or to save enough to build something. Very small housing authority, small villages don't receive enough of the Indian Housing Block Grant every year to operate and build. So what's likely happened is in the 2000s, Atna went through probably a decade of having to save for a construction project. I know in the 2000s they began, they had two six-unit developments in the mid-2000s. So this one we definitely need to update in terms of timescale.
And if it's okay, Chair, one more quick question. 3D printed housing in rural Alaska, do you have any thoughts on that and how feasible it would be?
Through the chair, yes. Representative Gray, so any time we have to build a home in rural Alaska, we have to make sure that what we choose is something that anyone can build and that anyone can fix. Because if something goes wrong, we don't want to be reliant on the one dude in San Jose who knows how to fix it. Because then his time is incredibly expensive and there's a long lead time to getting there. That's a sort of trite way of saying that the best piece of housing technology in rural Alaska is a Toyo stove. And the reason is in every village, there's multiple people who know how to work on a Toyo stove. And if a Toyo stove goes down, either someone's family member knows how to fix it, someone's got spare parts, it's ubiquitous, and it may not be the newest, it may not be the sexiest, but in the middle of January, when literally no planes can get in and people are without heat, someone can fix it. And I apply that thinking to every piece of building technology.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Klarok. We have a little bit of time if there are any committee members that wish to comment. No? Okay. Seeing none, we will adjourn. We do have 5:30 subcommittee, but this concludes our business for the day, and let the record reflect the time is 5:04 p.m.